Good morning or afternoon, and welcome to this complimentary teleseminar sponsored by College Achievement Alliance. We provide solutions to help you increase retention and completion rates for under-resourced students and transform individual lives, your institution, and your community. My name is Barbara Duncanson, and I am the Engagement Manager for College Achievement Alliance. Our presenter today is Dr. Bethany Tucker, an experienced consultant with AHA process in both K-12 and higher education. Bethany also is the author of Tucker Signing Strategies for Reading and co-author of the book Understanding and Engaging Under-Resourced College Students. You can read more about Bethany on our consultants page at www.collegeachievementalliance.com. Bethany's topic today is the human learning process and under-resourced students. But before we begin, just a couple of housekeeping items. I have muted everyone, so if you have a question or a comment, please hold it until the end of the presentation and use 5-star, that's 5-star on your phone to indicate that you would like to speak. The teleseminar is being recorded. If you registered for this teleseminar, we'll send you a follow-up email with a link to the recording. Watch your email for that link and feel free to share with your colleagues. Also, the link to the teleseminar recording will be posted on our Facebook page, which you can find at www.facebook.com/College Achievement Alliance. Please like us to get the latest updates on complimentary events and special offers, as well as news and tips we hope you can use. And now I will turn this over to our presenter today, Bethany Tucker. And yes, Bethany, I did hear you just a moment ago, so you should be good.
Great. So I am live. Everyone else, my email address is B Tucker. That's B as in boy, Tucker, T-U-C-K-E-R. At ahaprocess.com. As we're going through, I will have my email account open, so please feel free to send questions, or as Barbara said, press, was it star 5? What was?
Let's see, it is 5-star.
5-star if you have questions. I welcome questions at any point. We will talk today about an overview of research on the human learning process. This research, of course, comes from many sources. My outline comes primarily from a book titled Building Expertise, subtitled Cognitive Methods for Training and Performance. I'll repeat that. Building Expertise, subtitle Cognitive Methods for Training and Performance. The author's last name is Clark. The author, of course, cites many, many, many researchers, many studies. I will not try to provide all of those study references or all of the researchers' names, but if there is a particular study that you find interesting and would like to know more information about that particular researcher, please drop me an email. Again, btucker@ahaprocess.com. But we will talk about, as I said, the human learning process. And I have heard Ruby Peng many times make the comment in her workshops that teaching is outside of the brain. Learning is inside of the brain. Recently, when I conducted a workshop for college faculty and staff, I presented this quote, teaching is outside of the brain, learning is inside of the brain. And then I ask the participants to talk among themselves, for which are we responsible? And this resulted in a lively discussion. About two-thirds of the attendees said, we're responsible for both. By the end of the day, 100% of those in attendance said, we're responsible for both. We're not just responsible for standing up in front of the classroom and sharing information. We're responsible for what goes on inside of the student's head because, of course, if the student has not learned, then we have not taught. So we'll work with that assumption that we're responsible for what goes on inside of the student's head. So So what does go on there? If I'm standing up in front of the class and sharing tidbits of information, one bit of research that we have known for decades is that information goes first into short-term memory. Now, there are characteristics of short-term memory that educators benefit from knowing. One, this is not new, is that there are capacity limits. But what is new is this. A couple of decades ago, researchers told us that we could remember 7 plus or minus 2 bits of information. This data has been revised. The research has been revised. We now know that people can remember from 4 to 5 chunks, not just seven plus or minus 2 bits of information, but from 4 to 5 chunks of information. So examining this research through the lens of resourced and under-resourced students, this is huge, because if I'm under-resourced and if my professor starts talking about the beautiful state of California or Arizona or shrimp boating on the coast, if I have visited those states or if I have read about those states, then large chunks of information move from my long-term memory into my short-term memory, and I have a huge chunk to which I can add that new bit of information. So I can therefore deal with larger chunks of information. If my professor starts talking about something with which I am totally unfamiliar, then I can quickly become overwhelmed. I quickly reach my capacity limit, because short-term memory, again, is the bottleneck of memory. It is limited to what can get into, it limits what can get into the brain. So this is an implication for under-resourced students. If they lack the background information, then their chunks that exist in their short-term memory will be much smaller. In addition, we can keep in mind stress, or what researchers call allostatic load. Stress reduces the capacity. So if I have a student in my classroom who is stressed because of environmental factors, because of any type of reality in life, then that student can only deal with 1 or 2 pieces of information. In fact, if I myself create that stress, then I am limiting what my students can do. Barbara Soundcheck, am I still on?
You're on, Bethany.
Okay.
You're fine.
Okay. I heard a click, and I was concerned. Okay, moving on. When we think about short-term memory and capacity limits, researchers generally agree that capacity limits apply to all human beings, which makes us wonder about multitasking. We hear students, we hear adults claim to be multitaskers. Well, what researchers tell us is this. A person who calls himself or herself a multitasker is, in fact, a person who can switch back and forth and back and forth and back and forth from one external stimuli to another, kind of the way we flip channels on a TV. Research says that in terms of auditory intake, I cannot listen. Human beings cannot listen to 2 conversations at one time. We can switch back and forth, and when we're watching TV, we can use that remote control to switch back and forth very rapidly. But that does not mean that I'm taking in more than one bit of information at a time. So when people multitask, what they're really doing is switching from one external source to another. And at the end of the day, their brains are exhausted. At the end of the hour or the end of the class, their brains are exhausted because they are skilled not at multitasking, but at switching back and forth. Researchers also tell us that this concept of a photographic memory does not exist, because they will tell us that they have yet to find a human being who can remember everything that they see, hear, or read, because information goes into short-term memory, and it doesn't make it into long-term memory unless it has been processed. So some people are indeed more skilled at processing information, but the individual who truly has a photographic memory is yet to be found. So, as educators, our concern is how do we enhance a student's capacity limits? If we overload working memory, their working memory will shut off any new information within 12 seconds. So if I present overload to my students, they stop listening. They know that their brains are full. Their brains say, hey, I'm full, I don't want to hear anymore. So they stop listening. And what we must do is to give them chunks of information and give them opportunities to rehearse or to process that information. So looking at our handout, we are talking now about short-term or working memory. The first characteristic of short-term or working memory is capacity limit. We have a limited capacity, but this limited capacity isn't all bad. If we had an unlimited short-term working memory capacity, then our students would be taking in everything that goes on around them. They wouldn't tune anything out, and then at the end of the day, they wouldn't know how to filter what was important and what was not. So, number one, capacity limits. The second characteristic of short-term or working memory, and I have alluded to this, is that this is where processing takes place. And number three, I'll cover the third one as well. There are separate storage areas for visual and auditory information. So we have three characteristics of short-term memory. Capacity limits, it's where processing takes place, and there are separate storage areas for visual and auditory information. Now, thinking about long-term memory, moving on down the list, we're giving an overview of these characteristics first, and then we'll come back and revisit each of these. But let's look very quickly at long-term memory, and then we'll come back and look at it again in more detail. When we think of long-term memory, the first characteristic is that it has huge storage capacity. Everything we've ever learned, everything we've ever known, is stored in our long-term memory. Looking at the next characteristic, there are two types of memory, fact and processes. If we could imagine having two filing cabinets in our brains, in our long-term memory, one would be labeled facts and one would be labeled processes. We recall from long-term memory information, and we recall how to do things. And for those of you who are familiar with Ruby Payne's work, you will know that she talks quite a bit about processes. And she talks about how we as educators can benefit our students by teaching them processes. If we are familiar with the work of Ruby Feuerstein, who studied under-resourced students for decades, explains to us that some students struggle in our classes, not because they lack the information or not because they don't get the information, they don't understand the information that we're teaching, they do. But he said many of them simply have not learned the processes that we expect them to know, such as how to plan, how to control impulsivity, how to prioritize. These are the processes. That's that second filing cabinet. So it behooves us as educators to realize that every student has two filing cabinets in their brains, in their long-term memory, one labeled facts, one labeled processes. we need to help them to fill both filing cabinets. And when we think about that filing cabinet label, facts, we can realize, of course, that some students who don't know how to organize will just throw those facts into the filing cabinet in no order. And we can help them to retrieve that information if we tell them where to file it. If we say, now this information relates to wars, we're studying wars in social studies, and to help them to know how to file that information, then they will be able to retrieve it. When we move down our list, we see the term encoding. New information must be encoded from short-term into long-term memory, or it disappears. I can tell you, for example, that my cell phone number is 843-907-6617. My address is 1932 Norwood Street, Southwest Ocean Isle Beach, North Carolina. Now, you did not have time to process my telephone number, and I dare say that there's no one who can remember it. And this is what encoding is all about. And if we as educators just give information without the opportunity to process, then encoding does not take place. And if I do not encode, if I do not store in long-term memory, then I cannot retrieve. Now, looking further down the list of your handout, you see the words attention, self-regulation, metacognition, and motivation. These are outside of the brain, and yet they're inside of the brain. What's inside of the brain will help me to pay attention. However, as educators, we can enhance this process. We'll talk toward the end of the hour about these four components. At the very bottom of your handout, you see the source that I mentioned earlier, the source from which I drew the outline of my information. Of course, we go from here to read in more detail, but that's the general outline. So let's go back now and look a little more closely at each of these components. But first, Barb, if we could unmute people to see if there are any questions at this point before we go into more detail, that would be great. I think we're unmuted. Can you all please let me know if you're there?
Hello, yes.
Hello? Okay, I hear some happy hellos. Are there questions or concerns to this point before we look in more detail at each of the components? Well, if not, let's go back up to the top of the list then.
Conference muted.
Okay, great. Looking at, in a little more detail at short-term memory, if indeed our students have a limited capacity for short-term memory, then the question for us becomes, how can we manage cognitive load? Our students can only hold on to 4 to 5 chunks. How can we manage this load so that they can be more resourceful? One thing we can keep in mind is that, and I alluded to this earlier, chunk size can vary depending on the content of long-term memory. The more knowledge that a student has stored in the long-term memory, the greater the size of the chunk that they can hold on to. So this is one reason why, as college professors, as we work with high schools and middle schools and elementary schools, enrichment programs are critical, but they're critical not just for gifted students. They're critical for under-resourced students. So when they hear talk about another state or an activity, they can relate to it in some way. Unfortunately, research does tell us that novices are the ones who are most frequently overloaded, especially by expert teachers. If I'm an absolute expert in my field, I find it more difficult to teach at a level that is understandable for students who have very little in terms of long-term memory. So again, our question becomes, what are some strategies that we can use to manage cognitive load in short-term memory? One thing we can do is to activate prior knowledge. We've all heard about activating prior knowledge before, but what I didn't know until I read research recently is, and I'm reading a quote, research points to prior knowledge as the most significant learner characteristic influencing learning. Again, if I'm a learner with adequate prior knowledge, then I will be more successful in acquiring new knowledge. Therefore, the number one recommendation for us as educators is to activate prior knowledge. Researchers warn us we cannot assume that just because we stand up and start talking about a topic that students will by themselves say, oh, yes, this belongs in such and such a file drawer, such and such a folder in my filing cabinet of long-term memory. They don't know that. It is very beneficial for them if we activate that prior knowledge and we tell them exactly where this information should be filed. A really effective strategy, according to researchers, is to have students answer pre-questions related to the content based on prior knowledge. Anticipation guides, anything that can help them to get into that filing cabinet, get into that particular folder and to pull out the appropriate information and to have them answer questions. Pre-questions is particularly effective. In fact, I remember when I was a student studying at the University of Virginia, I learned more from one particular class than I think I learned in all of my other courses combined. This was a history course in education, and my professor gave us our discussion questions for our exam, for our end-of-the-term exam, on the first day of class. He said, these are your discussion questions. I remember as I sat through his lectures, I would frequently say to myself, that's an answer to that question. And I guarantee that I learned more in that class than I have learned in all of my other courses because of the fact that it activated that prior knowledge. A formula would be new content plus activated memories equal learning. And this is what the research is telling us, that when we combine new content with activated memories, then learning does occur. Research also tells us that one of the most effective strategies for activating prior knowledge is to have students participate in a group discussion of a problem or case study related to the content of the lesson. We could easily see how this could happen in the field of nursing or education. Here is a situation that occurred. Study this case study. And then we will talk more about it. And we can see how this is an extremely effective strategy. In fact, this strategy of having group discussions about a problem, according to the research, is more effective than having individual students reading about a related topic because they help one another to activate prior knowledge. I kind of lost my track here. Okay, another strategy for activating prior knowledge is what is referred to as a KWL chart. Many of you are probably familiar with this, but for those who might not be, the K stands for know. What do I already know about this topic? The W stands for want. What do I want to know about this topic? And the L column is to be completed at the end of the study, and this is where I list what I have learned. Now, research warns us that this strategy is effective when the columns are filled out in groups, either by the whole class or in groups. The strategy is not effective when students try to individually. If I'm a student who knows nothing about shrimp boating and you ask me, what do I know about shrimp boating? I don't know anything. So it does me no good to make a list of what I don't know. But in groups, if another student says, well, shrimp boats have big Barbara, I heard a noise. Am I still on?
You're fine.
Okay. Thank you. When my peers say to me that a shrimp boat looks like this or does this, then that can benefit me quite a bit. So your reference, if you wish to read more about this, is KWL, the KWL chart. When we activate prior knowledge, it's important to keep in mind that what we're trying to do is to connect unfamiliar or new information with familiar information. One example that I read about in research, when some researchers were teaching the concept of transmission, and they were talking about how sound or a pulse rate travels from an antenna. The students were really struggling with the concept. And then they started bouncing a ball, and they said, what if I bounce this ball really high in the sky and it bounced off of an airplane? This is what transmission is all about. They understood because they knew what a bouncing ball was. They knew what an airplane was. So whenever we can relate new information to familiar information, then they have a better chance of grasping the concept. Ruby Payne refers to this type of teaching as teaching using mental models, and it is highly effective. So looking again at our handout, we are talking once again about capacity limits. So if I know that my students have capacity limits, if their short-term memory has capacity limits, I need to manage the cognitive load. I can do this, as we just said, by activating prior knowledge. Now, moving on, I must also compensate for missing prior knowledge, and this is where our understanding of under-resourced students come in. Many of them are missing that prior knowledge, and their scores on tests are lower, not because they lack intelligence, but because they have less prior knowledge related to a topic. They can't connect any new information to familiar information. Therefore, and this particular point will prompt a great deal of discussion among faculty, researchers tell us we can help students by giving them an outline of a lesson at the beginning of the lesson, by giving them a list of key points, by giving them discussion questions, by giving them key vocabulary. This can help to compensate for missing prior knowledge. If indeed prior knowledge is the number one determiner as to whether or not I will be successful, then if indeed I have inadequate prior knowledge, then I have less of a chance of being successful in a class. Once again, an outline of course content, a list of key points, discussion questions. I mentioned earlier that this concept is often debated, even resisted among some faculty because they're saying, well, that's hand-holding, that's coddling. Again, what we're doing is compensating for missing prior knowledge. Okay? This next bit of research, if you have the opportunity to read about minimization of activation of irrelevant prior knowledge, I'll say that again, minimizing the activation of irrelevant prior knowledge. This is fascinating research, and it counters much of what I have done in my teaching throughout my life, throughout my teaching career. The research says to beware the harmful effects of seductive details, and seductive details are interesting tidbits of information, But if those tidbits of information are not directly 100% related to my topic, then they distract rather than teach. So the point here is to minimize the activation of irrelevant prior information. When I think about minimizing irrelevant information, I think immediately about making aside comments. Since I have read this research and as I listen to speakers, I pay close attention to side comments that they make, and then I pay close attention to the audience, and I have noticed that it is absolutely true when a speaker makes a side comment with the purpose of livening everything up. But if that side comment is not directly related, then people get distracted and they start their own side conversations that are off task. Something else that we can do. We've been talking about prior knowledge. That was step one. Step two, under managing cognitive load because of those cognitive limits, is to allow content to bypass short-term memory. This is fascinating work as well. An example is providing external task aids. Any kind of list that we can post on the wall in our classrooms and refer to that list can allow this information to bypass working memory. An example is this handout that I sent. With this handout, then I don't have to dwell on, I don't have to process short-term memory, long-term memory. Where are we now? Because it's right there in front of me. And the more of such aids that we can provide to our students in the form of external task aids, then the more able they will be to bypass working memory. And if I bypass working memory, then I have open cognitive space in that 4 to 5 available chunks of information. We can do this with graphs, charts, checklists, online wizards, procedures lists, and this is why in classrooms it is so important for students to know what our procedures are. When do I ask for a pencil if I run out of ink? Exactly what we want them to do in our classrooms. In Ruby Payne's work, we find, for example, the description of classificatory writing, paragraph 1, 3 sentences, paragraph 2, 8 sentences. And we hear the argument sometimes that this is formula writing or, worse, hand-holding. But this is exactly what researchers are saying can help students to bypass working memory. If I'm trying to recall exactly what goes into each paragraph of classificatory writing, then I can take in no new information. That's all for the day. So such wizards and charts in the classroom can help to bypass working memory. In Ruby Payne's work, you will find many examples of how to go about this. Procedures lists are important in college as well as the elementary school, of course. So we can bypass working memory by providing external memory aids. We can also provide internal memory support by developing skills to automaticity. Automaticity refers to what happens to us when we leave work, we crank our car, and then the next thing we know, we're home, and we don't know how we got there. That's happened to all of us. This is a description of automaticity. Our skills of driving have reached that level of being automatic. I realize that you're college people, but an example at the elementary level would be the reality that not too many years ago, educators decided that we would no longer require middle grade students, elementary students, to memorize the multiplication table. They said that we can use calculators. Well, what we found was that the process of using that calculator took up so much processing space that students lagged, their skills were lagging, and now we're back to realizing that some of our students must acquire, all of our students must acquire some skills to automaticity. In fact, another example of this, researchers found that if we ask students questions in the middle of a reading passage, or college students, this can enhance their reading. If we ask young children questions in the middle of their reading, it diminishes their comprehension because their decoding skills have not reached the level of automaticity. And one way that this can take place is through drill and practice. And there are computer programs and activities that can take place in college classrooms that can help students, especially the area of math or even in education when we are requiring students to remember many names, many theories that can take them to the level of automaticity. So, again, we're looking at short-term memory. To manage cognitive load, we can activate prior knowledge. We can allow content to bypass working memory. And, of course, we can introduce essential content gradually. And I know that this takes practice as a college professor for me to remember that I present four or five chunks of information, and then I give the students time to process. I must give them that processing time. If I think, gee, I have to cover the content, then sure, I'm covering it outside of their heads, but nothing is going on, or very little is going on inside of their heads. Something else we can do is to help students to focus on central content. And what we're talking about here is nice to know versus need to know. And we can do this by omitting unnecessary details. In a really fascinating study about how lightning forms, some researchers for a control group added information to liven up the lesson. And this information was all about what happens when lightning strikes an airplane or when golfers are on the course and why they're susceptible to lightning strikes. When the students were tested, we might guess that the students with the enhanced information scored better. But actually, the opposite is true. The students who received just the targeted information outperformed the others. What this is telling us is not that we should forever omit those interesting stories, but what it is telling us is that we absolutely must give our students a list of key points, an outline, and then give them that critical information and say, now, let me share with you an interesting story to help illustrate this and help them to understand what is important, what is critical, what's nice to know, and what isn't. I want to ask you a question. I realize your speakers are muted and you might not be able to answer, but think to yourself about this question. Which lesson was learned most effectively by college students? We have college students in a classroom. Some of them studied a lesson that included animation to illustrate how something works. We'll say something as simple as pumping up a tire. The other group studied that same information using still frames. I won't ask you to punch 5-star, but in your mind, please decide for yourself which group learned the most, those who had animations or those who had still frames. And the answer is those who had still frames. Animation often includes background distractions, noise distractions. The still frames were much more focused, and students learn more. So, again, the key point is that we must help students to focus on the key points. Now, the next question I found very disturbing because from before teaching at a university, I taught everything, K through college. After 40 years, we've taught everything that I taught in elementary school for some of those years. And I would pride myself in providing a relaxing environment conducive to learning by playing background music. What the research is telling me now is that background music was a distraction and students can actually learn better with no background music. In fact, they learn better with no accompanying sounds at all. Continuing to move down the list, something else that we can do is to provide summaries or have students to summarize. If students can read summaries of lessons prior to actually studying the course, they will outperform students who do not. In fact, in research studies, some students were given summaries to read. Others read the whole chapter. Now, of course, the students who read the whole chapter did better on detailed questions, but the students who simply read a summary did much better years later or months later in terms of retention and transfer than those who read the whole passage. We're not saying, of course, study from summaries. We're not saying omit everything. But what the research tells us very clearly is that we must, as educators, help our students to understand these are the three key points of the lesson today. Everything else will be for enhancement, or these are the key 9 points. Something that we don't do in college very often, but we'll mention it, is to avoid redundant modes. In college, we would never read to students, but if you're showing PowerPoint slides, and if we ask our students to read that slide, if we read along with them, if we read it for them, they are distracted. They're attempting to adjust their reading pace to match your speaking pace. And many times students will try to read along with us, and once the slide is read, they don't have a clue what was just read. Research says let them read it themselves, because that we are minimizing redundant modes by not reading it to them. So we have talked about managing cognitive load. We activate prior knowledge. We allow content to bypass working memory. We introduce content gradually, and we focus on central content. Now, there is a strategy that can help us to minimize wasted mental work. How much of the mental work that is going on in classrooms is productive, and how much of that mental work is actually wasted? Research does tell us that solving 50 math problems is much less effective. And by the way, the number 50 was off the top of my head, but solving a number of math problems is much less effective than analyzing worked problems. And according to what I've read, this is not only true in math, but it's true in courses such as education, chemistry. We give students worked problems and have them analyze the worked problems is much more effective than working problem after problem after problem. And we have opportunities. One approach would be to have students themselves work a couple of problems, turn their papers in with a secret code, their secret number on the paper, so that only the teacher knows which paper belongs to which students, redistribute the papers, have the students correct the paper they just received using a model given to them by the teachers. So what they're having to do is to analyze a worked problem and to transfer that information onto a new paper. This is a highly effective approach, much more so than just having them to work many problems. Another approach would be to give out two sets of papers, A and B. Student A works problem A, student B works problem B, and then they get in groups and explain their question and their answer to their students. This, again, is much more effective than working many, many problems. Looking back at our list of short-term memory, and I know that I'm quickly running out of time. I will stop in just a few minutes. it's needless to say we didn't cover all of the brain research, because I think it would take us a year to do so, but we covered as much as we could during this time period. What we know about short-term memory is this is where processing takes place. A key point that I do want to make, however, is the importance of using lecture, words, and graphics, because research tells us that our short-term memory has separate storage areas for words and graphics. So if I teach using words and graphics at the same time, I have essentially doubled my effectiveness. So if we're working with professors and we see them simply lecturing without graphics, then one recommendation would be, where are your PowerPoint? Where's your list? Where are your charts? Because research by Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, and others have found that adding visuals can result in 89% advantage in learning outcomes, and this is at all levels. Very quickly, encoding is taking information into the brain, and there are strategies in Ruby Payne's work and other work that is very important. But the last point that I'll try to make is this. As we teach, we can help our students to grasp the content by pointing out patterns, because research tells us that experts see patterns. The last research project I'll share with you involves chess players, and we all hear that chess players are usually very, very smart people, and they probably are. But research also tells us that chess players know patterns. They look for patterns. In this particular experiment, expert chess players and novice chess players were both shown two mid-game chess boards, and then they were asked to try to replicate those boards. The experts could with a large accuracy. The novices could not. Then they were asked to replicate a board that had no pattern, no meaning. The experts actually did worse than the novices because they were looking for patterns that did not exist. So when we can say to students in a social studies class, for example, we are talking, one pattern in social studies is that of war. Wars have happened forever, and there are causes of war. Let's talk about what caused this war. What caused the war we talked about last week? What might cause an upcoming war? And students are then analyzing and learning to recognize patterns in life. This is one of the most effective strategies for helping students to know how to file this information, this new information that we're giving them. Students, go to that filing cabinet on information. Go to your folder labeled Social Studies. Look inside of that. Take out the sheet of paper labeled Wars. This is a pattern. This can help them to know how to store and to encode this new information. Again, brain research is fascinating. We could talk forever. I have monitored my email. I do not see any new emails at this point. So, Barbara, could I turn this over to you to unmute, and we will address questions?
Certainly. If you have a question, this is your opportunity, or a comment that you'd like to share with us, please do.
Yes, I do have a question regarding the background music or background sound.
Okay.
Okay, I have read previous information that talks about the Mozart effect. So are they now saying that playing classical music in the background when studying or in that type of environment is not effective?
I'm so glad you asked this question, because I failed to clarify that background information during introductions, et cetera, can be very effective, especially an online course that starts with background music. And I am familiar with the Mozart effect studies, and I had that same question.
Okay.
What the new research is telling us is that for many, many students, especially your novices, that background information can be distracting. Again, I'm glad you brought this up because it does appear that the information is conflicting. But what I think the research is telling us is that we want to be very careful as to when. If students are processing new information, the background noise can be distracting. If students are creating, then the Mozart effect takes place, and that's when it can actually enhance creativity. That's my interpretation.
Okay, I like that. That makes perfect sense. Thank you
for asking that question. Great question. And my apologies for not making that clearer earlier.
Okay, other questions or comments?
Well, we have 5 more minutes. The last bit of the handout relates to attention. Of course, if we don't get the students' attention, they won't hear anything we have to say anyway. And this is why some of the cueing techniques that we use, students, this is important. Students, this will be on the test. These are effective. Engaging students using Think, Pair, Share. I realize that some college professors are experts in their field but have not had the advantage of education courses. If you work with college professors who are concerned about whether or not their students are learning the material, you might refer them to cooperative learning strategies such as Think, Pair, Share and help them to understand that when we say use cooperative learning, we're not talking about your top students teaching your struggling students. That's not what it is about at all. What it is about is giving them opportunities to process. Think, Pair, Share is to simply say, I want you to think. No hands up, no answering, just think. Now, talk to your neighbor. Now we'll share with the whole class. Just giving them the processing opportunities. Yes, no cards, thumbs up, thumbs down, dry erase boards. All of these are great strategies for helping students to focus. I'm sorry, I think I heard someone asking a question. Okay, very quickly, and the last little tidbit of information is related to motivation. A strategy that I have found to be the favorite that I present during my workshops is when we have students who say, I can't do this work, or I don't understand this, have them to repeat that statement, but add the word yet. I can't do this work yet. And it totally changes the mindset. The student is no longer thinking forever. When we think about learned helplessness, I highly recommend that you Google the person who coined the term learned helplessness. His name is Seligman, Seligman. I recommend his video. Sometimes when we talk about learned helplessness, we identify the problem and we stop there. But Seligman takes us to the next step. He gives us a way to deal with learned helplessness. The strategy I just mentioned, I can't do this yet, helps us to deal with learned helplessness because when a person has learned to be helpless, that person thinks that their inability to grasp a concept is permanent. I'll never be a good student. When we can help them to get past that feeling, that they'll struggle forever and ever, if we can help them to understand that this is a temporary state, then we can help them to overcome learned helplessness. A perfect example of learned helplessness is the elephant that we see in zoos, the elephant tied by a small rope. And the elephant doesn't run because when he was young, he was chained could not run, and that elephant forever believes that he'll never be able to escape, so he quits trying. That's learned helplessness. If we can help students to understand, this is not forever. It's a temporary struggle. That's what life is about. I can't do this work yet. Then we can have students to overcome the concept of learned helplessness. We are down to our last 2 minutes. Once again, I'll stop to address questions or concerns. And while Barbara asks if there are any questions, I'm checking my email to see if any have been typed in. No, I have none.
Can I ask just a little bit of a clarification? What did you say again regarding, you said learned helplessness?
Yes, L-E-A-R-N-E-D, learned helplessness. I recommend that you Google this. You will see the name Seligman, S-E-L-I-G-M-A-N. He coined this term several decades ago. And learned helplessness is, of course, areas in our lives in which we feel helpless. And the reality is that we have learned to feel helpless. For example, the number one fear among adults in this country is the fear of speaking in public. We were not born afraid to speak in public. When we were babies, we screamed at airports. We were not afraid. But throughout life, we have learned, gee, I can't talk in front of people. Gee, I can't do that. We've learned to be helpless.
Okay.
The number two fear is death. So technically, we're more afraid of speaking in public than we are of dying.
Right.
But many of our students have learned to be helpless. They think they'll never get it, they'll never improve, and we can help them to overcome learned helplessness by helping them to understand that their struggles are temporary. And Seligman, in his videotape, will give you 4 characteristics of learned helplessness, and he will give you suggestions for helping students to get past those learned helpless conditions.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you for that question.
We have about 1 minute left here. Any other further comments or questions before we sign off? Hearing none, then, I will invite you to email Bethany with any questions you think of later, and her email address is btucker@ahaprocess.com. Also, feel free to email me. My email address is bduncanson, and that is bduncanson @ahaprocess.com. Watch your email later today for the link to this recording. And also, we invite you to like us on Facebook, which is www.facebook.com/College Achievement Alliance, and the link will also be at that location. So thank you so much to all of you for joining us and for having the confidence that we would solve our technological difficulties and for being with us today. And thank you as well for everything you are doing for the under-resourced students in your institution. And with that, we will say goodbye.
Thank you.